Welcome Policy Fellow at the South African Institute of Race Relations, Sarah Gon.
As always, great to chat to you, Sarah. Take it you well.
I am indeed. New summer.
Also, thank you very much. I definitely think that in your next lifetime you should go into advertising because you have an absolute gift for thinking of topics that are so interesting. So the topic today is just fire them, exclamation mark and fire in caps. Who are we firing and why?
Well, I think we're all thoroughly depressed by the promise by the government to fight corruption. And we don't kind of believe it can achieve it or wants to or whatever, but it needs to do it or be seen to do it in order to satisfy our overseas lenders. If I've got an idea, because corruption, you know, charging people with corruption is a lengthy process. It's about finding the evidence. It's about finding the manpower to investigate it and then to prosecute it. And we will go way beyond my lifetime before we start to see any real progress. What I want to suggest is that I would love to suggest that the government do what the private sector does, which, I mean, whatever what the private sector does, the government's allowed to do, and that is this. Every company is entitled to discipline its staff, and every company is entitled to fire a staff member who's been found guilty of gross misconduct. Now, this is absolutely the same. The same applies to the government sector. Now, if you think about it, it should take, depending on the case, maybe 2 weeks to 2 months to resolve the firing of someone for gross misconduct in the way of corruption. And I think it offers a sort of disincentive on two levels. One is it happens fairly relatively quickly compared to criminal action. And the other is that you lose a job, you will probably never be employed again. And that is probably a greater disincentive than criminal action, because criminal action just goes on. There's only one problem, and that is that to apply your very own labor laws, the government would have to can the whole concept of cadre deployment. And unless it does this, the one cannot happen without the other, because what tends to happen is when people commit acts of misconduct, they get put on suspension for abnormally long periods of time, while we always seem to wait for what criminal action may or may not be taken. And the important thing to know is that it's irrelevant what criminal action may or may not be taken. Disciplinary processes run parallel to criminal processes. The one has nothing to do with the other. A company, an organization is entitled to take disciplinary action irrespective of what is happening in the courts. And the test for determining whether someone's committed misconduct in the organizational sphere is only on a balance of probabilities, whereas in the criminal courts, it's beyond reasonable doubt. So it's a much heavier onus to meet. And that's why it would be quicker and easier to fire people. And it doesn't, even if the person is found not guilty or the case is withdrawn for some reason, they can come back and say, please, you must rehire me because the courts have not found me guilty. And the employer can say, well, that's irrelevant. We did under the requirements we are required to meet. What's happened in the court is irrelevant. And I hate to say that it's kind of that simple, but I think it's a much, much more effective way of dealing with the sort of the sheer scale of the corruption we're dealing with. But perhaps I just live hope over experience.
So I was going to tell you, I mean, I'm listening to that and I'm thinking, what a beautiful shortcut to some sort of decency, and wouldn't get go so far in restoring our faith in government. And yet, just this week, and I'm not sure if it was Esmach Achashula or David Mabuza, I'm not sure, but if the rot is at the absolute top, I mean, then there's no political will to deal with this. Who got on television this week saying, no, it's okay for my family to do business as long as they disclose it? I mean, it's not okay.
Well, you see, the funny thing is, I mean, the beauty of all of this hypocrisy with all in capital letters is that Ace Magashule he's involved in the one case that they actually might reach an end with before I shuck off this mortal coil. He's also, it's been revealed that his two sons benefited from COVID contracts. And he's the one who first said this. Now he's come out and said, no, this is absolutely untenable and it's awful and we mustn't tolerate it. And you think, someone please put me out of my misery. I do not believe what I have just heard from really, with all due respect, the scuzziest of party officials. And so that's why we don't believe them. And that's why actually nothing will happen. But in case anyone's, you know, wants to use my idea and exercise God-given rights under the labor law.
Feel free. Welcome. You heard it here on 101.9 Chai FM. Not going to let you go right now because an article that I came across in the Daily Maverick today really, really interested me. It was an article by Stephen Grotus. It talks to exactly what you're talking about, a bankrupt, a morally bankrupt ANC, a DA that, I don't know, you won't agree with me, but I think is like a lemming, is just gone off a cliff. And it's left this sort of open middle ground. And Stephen Grotus's argument is that the man who's going to most probably benefit the most from this moral and ideological atrophy, he says, is Herman Mashaba and his new outfit. And I thought, who better than you to comment on that?
Well, see, that's an interesting one because in many ways, Herman Mashaba fits the bill. He's a conservative with a small C. And a lot of his programs would appeal to ordinary people. And he certainly is dynamic. But I have to go with John Steenhuisen on this. One is that it takes a lot of money, a lot of money to effectively get even a provincially based party off the ground as opposed to a nationally based party. And the other thing is that Herman Mashaba, and I know people who worked under him directly, is maybe not as ideal a candidate as one would want to support. But having said that, I do think he has quite something of what it takes to put up something of a fight. I wait to see what happens with the DA, but I've certainly got the sense that they're recovering a little bit of muscularity. So basically, at the end of the day, I mean, given what we've had, you go with the best that's available at the time. You can't go with the best party because there's no such thing as the best party, least of all in our context. Yeah. So it's really, at the end of the day, when it comes to next year and 4 years' time, the question is, who is the best at the time?
Sorry, and you spoke about... You spoke about funds as being a barrier to entry, the need to raise capital. In the day of social media, has that not equalized the playing field somewhat?
It may have, but you know, what you really need, and I've seen it, I'm sort of aware with some of how the DA runs it, you know, sort of exposed to something about a year or so ago. And to actually, social media is a great assistance. You can use it very well. The problem is that you need an enormously robust organizational backing. You need people who are prepared to stump on the ground and do the heavy lifting. And it's that sort of backup that takes time both to organize and to really get some benefit from. And I think that might be a reflection to some extent of that although there's certainly some organizational capacity, the EFF hasn't really made a dent nationally, because it's too aggressive and too parochial and too racist, but also it needs a lot of money to get that presence that can make a difference nationally.
Interesting. It's 5 to 6, Sara. We're going to leave it there. That was Sara Ghan, the policy fellow at the South African Institute of Race Relations. Thanks as always.
Cheers.